Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement Ziad Nakhala described Soleimani as the martyr of Palestine and Al-Quds.
The U.S. assassinated Soleimani because he was a barrier to American Israeli plots in the region. He transformed the resistance fighters into a strategic threat to Israel and the U.S. I take this opportunity to say that we're proud of the positions of the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is unwavering in its support for the Palestinian resistance, and I witnessed that Qasem Soleimani was at the forefront of the fight in defense of Palestine and the people of Palestine.
The Iranian ambassador to Beirut also said that there is a joint Iranian-Iraqi judicial lawsuit being followed up by both countries to try the killers of the Iranian and Iraqi martyrs who were assassinated by the United States.
Resistance groups in the region consider General Qasem Soleimani as a man and a leader who united them. People in Lebanon, even those who knew him only after his martyrdom, see him as a man who transcended borders and sacrificed his life for the sake of the people and regional peace and stability. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
This international conference is the gathering of Islamic scholars converged in the port city of Karachi against Islamophobia. They believe Islamophobia is a Western project to reshape Islam with tools like Daesh and others.
Participants of the conference stress on the need of unity among Muslims and call on the Islamic countries to take serious notice of the forces hell-bent to sow seed of discords among Muslim Ummah.
Documentary films during the past years over the gruesome acts of Daesh in the name of Islam were played to remind people how terrorist groups were weaponized by Israel and the U.S. to distort the face of Islam in the West.
Actually, Islamophobia is a project of Western country who do not like the Western people come to Islam like Islam. And they mention many things that hurt the heart of the Islamic people, while Islam is the religious of love between the people.
This conference is very important for me, all Pakistanis and all Muslims, because there has been so many criminal activities on behalf of non-Muslims or Western countries against Islam and Muslims.
Member of the international conference warned the Islamic countries to act quickly against the possible future threats given the previous experience with the West.
Islamophobia had been created to balance the teachings of Ahle Bayt alayhimus salam. It was created to balance and misguide people from the way of Quran and Sunnah. Things took place in the name of Daesh and so-called. And they did things which were absolutely against the teachings of Islam. They never understood.
The delegation in the conference also stressed the significance of the eradication of Daesh from Iraq and Syria to save Islam and also save humanity from the plague of terrorist groups like Daesh, which is seen as a Western plot against Islam and the Islamic community. Mohammed Turi, Karachi.
Britain's highest rank for chivalry, awarded by Queen Elizabeth to former Prime Minister Tony Blair, a man described by campaigners as one of the most repugnant political figures in the world, in power from 1997 to 2007.
The backlash to the announcement has been immense and is only growing. Furious Iraq War veterans are now calling for the honor system to be overhauled. And more than 500,000 people have signed a petition calling on the Queen to strip the man they call a war criminal of his new title.
It's a designation routinely awarded to former prime ministers here, but anti-war campaigners say they're repulsed at seeing Blair receiving it. And they have their reasons.
For millions of people in this country, it's an absolute insult, as it is to the people of Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and various other places where we've now seen the war on terror over the last 20 years. And I don't see any justification for it whatsoever. I think that Blair never conceded that he was wrong about any of these things. The Chilcot inquiry, which was very, very critical of him, He immediately held a very long press conference afterwards and said he would do exactly the same again.
In mid-February 2003, just before the Iraq invasion, tens of millions of demonstrators in hundreds of cities across the world, including in London, marched against the impending U.S.-led war in the Middle East. To Tony Blair, the biggest protest march in British history was fatuous.
The fact is that had we been listened to and had Britain not taken part in the war almost certainly would not have taken place, that America would have been much less likely to go to war alone, and we would have seen a much different world today, a day where far more people would be alive as a result of that war not happening, would be far fewer refugees.
The U.S. claimed the regime of former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction and actively pressed for invading Iraq in late 2001. The weapons were never found. Two decades on, 1 million Iraqis dead, 3 million dispossessed, and a region reeling from terrorism and instability. Hundreds of British troops were also killed in the same conflict. Anti-war campaigners say Tony Blair belongs in the dock at The Hague, and not in the pantheon of great leaders. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah lashed out at the United States as the mother of corruption and terrorism in the region and stressed that the expulsion of U.S. forces from the region will be the final revenge for the U.S. assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi Popular Mobilization Units Commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in Baghdad in 2020.
We have declared earlier that the best revenge is the full withdrawal of U.S. troops from the region. And over the past 2 years, as the leader Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, the U.S. has been forced to leave Afghanistan with humiliation. This has led the U.S. allies to rethink their alliance with Washington.
In an address to a ceremony in Beirut remembering the martyrs Qasem Soleimani, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, and their companions, Sayyid Nasrallah also accused the U.S. of being behind all Israeli and Saudi crimes in the region for decades.
The lesson which I would like to highlight today is that everyone acting for the sake of God emerges victorious in all battles and wins the hearts and minds of all people across the Arab and Muslim worlds. They show us that the U.S. serves as the real enemy and source of corruption, occupation, and terrorism in our region.
Allies believe that the project of the resistance continues to face the criminality of the U.S. in Lebanon and the region.
Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani belongs to the school of thought of a struggle against the occupiers of our land and those who destroyed our homes and killed our people and led one war after the other with their support for the Zionists. He sacrificed his life and stood against terrorism in Iraq, Yemen, Syria, and Lebanon and Palestine. He taught us that Lebanon is strong enough and can remove itself from the U.S. hegemony.
The leader of the resistance stressed that the assassination of martyr Soleimani, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, has triggered a new phase at the regional level. The assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and PMU Commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis is seen as an incident larger than the region itself, and for many analysts has brought to light a long-term confrontation for Lebanon's Hezbollah facing U.S. influence in Lebanon and the region. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Caskets draped in Iranian flag contains the bodies of 150 Iranian soldiers whose remains have recently been found more than 3 decades after the end of the Iraqi-imposed war on Iran. The mourning procession in Tehran is part of a larger national event which saw similar memorial services held for 100 more martyrs in 24 provinces across the country. The funerals were attended by Iranian military and state officials as well as thousands of Iranians to pay tribute to the martyrs and also to observe the second anniversary of the U.S.'s assassination of top Iranian military figure, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani.
We have returned, and now the people are greeting those martyrs who have sacrificed their lives. General Soleimani also was a personality who has sacrificed his life in order to maintain the security of our country. Now this is a coincidence with the second anniversary of martyrdom of General Qasem Soleimani, and now they have returned. As you can see, everyone is holding the picture of General Qasem Soleimani, and this shows a reminder of the job that General Soleimani has done for our country.
General Soleimani fought for the security of our country and the region. He pushed back the terrorists, and this made him as a popular figure in the region.
Lieutenant General Soleimani was the commander of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. He was assassinated in a U.S. air raid outside Baghdad International Airport on a direct order from then-U.S. President Donald Trump. Soleimani is highly revered in the region for his anti-terror efforts and his role in eradicating Daesh terrorists from Iraq in 2017.
General Soleimani spent all his life fighting for our security, once in the Iraq-Iran war and then in the fight against terrorism. The U.S. assassinated him because he did not allow the terrorists to take over the region. The U.S. was with the terrorists.
We are all Qasem Soleimani. The United States thought in vain that if it killed our general, it would disrupt his endeavors, but we all will keep his legacy alive.
General Soleimani began his career as a soldier in the IRGC in the Iraq-Iran war. While above 200,000 Iranians are estimated to have either lost their lives or gone missing during the war. Over the years, the country has been carrying out search operations to recover the remains of those missing.
The Islamic Republic always holds such mass ceremonies to honor its martyrs, and General Soleimani is no exception, as the country also regards him as a martyr and a national hero. Now, on the second anniversary of Soleimani's assassination, Iranians have been using any chance to pay homage to him. These people say this is to preserve what Soleimani stood for. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en. On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to thee, addressing myself to thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
To Spotlight, Sudan security forces attacked anti-coup protesters with tear gas and live rounds in the African country's major cities, including the capital, Khartoum. Thousands of protesters filled the streets to express their strong opposition against the ruling military junta demanding a transition to civilian rule. Well, protests are nothing new to Sudan, where former leader Omar al-Bashir was deposed through a military coup in April 2019. After ruling over the country for three decades, in August of the same year, a transitional civilian military administration was founded to run the country. However, Sudan's military chief staged a coup and dissolved the fragile government. Abdallah Hamdok, the then prime minister, and other civilian leaders were all held in military detention. Hamdok was later released and signed a power-sharing deal with the junta. On Sunday, though, Hamdok resigned, leaving the military fully in charge. He said that Sudan was at a dangerous crossroads, threatening its very survival. Joining us on Spotlight, we have African affairs expert Lawrence Freeman, who's with us from Baltimore. And also journalist and African affairs expert Mubarak Henya is joining us from the Iranian capital, Tehran.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Freeman in Baltimore. Sir, why, in your opinion, has Sudan's democratic revolution been put on hold?
There are many reasons for this, and it's much more complicated than the average person thinks and gets from the media. There was no real thinking in advance of what would happen with the removal of Bashir. And now that when Bashir was removed, everybody really didn't have an idea of what's supposed to happen. And therefore, the situation has been very difficult for the last 2 years. The military is not used to ruling. The military is not used to dealing with the civilian government or demonstrators. You had the role of the security forces, which have been kept out of the current situation now for a number of months. You have a number of outside countries involved, including United Emirates, Qatar, Israel, Egypt, primarily. And then you have among the demonstrators themselves, you have legitimate students and demonstrators who want a better way of life. And then, of course, you have agitators, professionals using tear gas, Molotov cocktails, etc. So it's a very complex situation. The underlying problem that the current transition is having and that the government had under Bashir is that the economy is the key, that people's standard of living has not improved. Hamdok does not actually have a lot of credibility with people in Sudan or even outside of Sudan. They need to bring in people who are going to put forward a plan for economic development that represents the real interest of the people of Sudan. Now, I don't know if Bahani has that kind of vision. It doesn't appear at the moment he does. But if we're going to change the situation, we're going to have to bring in a new policy, a new paradigm for Sudan that focuses on infrastructure, economic development, and raising the material standard of living of the people. I believe that until we do that, the situation will continue with demonstrations and killings for some time ahead.
Mubarak Kenya, I'd like to get your perspective on what's going on in Sudan as well. What alternatives are there now that the civilian prime minister has resigned? The military has said it wants to replace the resigned Prime Minister Hamdok, but the junta has also been warned that if that happens without holding elections, it could undermine their own legitimacy, and it'll also damage the democratic drive of the people of Sudan. What do you think?
Well, I think what is happening in Sudan is a continuation of what we witnessed in the North African countries like Tunisia, Libya, and Egypt. And actually, the events in Sudan replicate what happened in Egypt, where the military hijacked the popular revolution of the people who overthrew an unpopular regime in Egypt. So the Sudanese military is reading from the same script as the Egyptian military. They have been collaborating very closely with the Fatah al-Sisi. General Burhan in Sudan has been collaborating closely, and they've been sharing notes. So we are seeing a repeat of what happened in Egypt in Sudan. And the military, the ultimate objective of the military is not to hand over power to the civilian, but to ultimately take over the control of the country through, quote-unquote, democratic means, where, like we had in Egypt, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi taking power. The same thing will happen in Sudan, is most likely to happen in Sudan. So the future for now looks bleak, and the situation, I believe, is going to escalate. And, of course, as Mr. Freeman said, there is the involvement of trans-regional powers who want to control Sudan for their own interests. We have Saudi Arabia, we have the UAE, and we have also the normalization deal with the Israeli regime. I think this is a major factor, that despite the fact that civilians have been killed, almost 57 civilians have been killed during the recent protests in Sudan, we are seeing very little or no condemnation from the a so-called international community. If it was happening in another country, there would have been UN resolutions, but because it's in Sudan and there is that major plan to, you know, to protect the normalization deal, so we expect the situation there to escalate.
Lawrence Freeman, the protesters, they are calling for a civilian caretaker government. They want democracy, it's democratic aspirations. As our guest just in Tehran mentioned, the outside world, do you think, is it doing enough to support those democratic aspirations of the Sudanese people?
But yeah, I think you have to be very careful when you use the word democracy, because the United States and the West have their version of democracy, which they try to impose on other countries, including African countries. I've been in Ethiopia many times this year defending the Ethiopians. State Department, their version of democracy. There are democratic aspirations, but the aspirations that are driving the people in Sudan, I was there many, many times, is the fact that they don't have a future that can see their economic development improve, that their children can have jobs, that they can have jobs, that they can have the housing and electricity and food and running water that is required by an economy. The problem is many of the proponents from the West who call for democracy leave out completely and wrongly the question of economic development. The other problem you have in Sudan is when it was finally freed from the British colonial powers, the military was a major national institution of the country. You had the military, you had the Secret Service, and you had the civilian service sector. And right now, the civilians are not represented. They don't have a powerful voice in determining the future of the country, and they don't have any policy. And this was one of the foolish things that the West did. Is they demanded the removal of Bashir over and over again, indicted him, but they had no plans for what to do afterwards for the country. And now Sudan is caught in a geopolitical manipulation where they recognized Israel in return for some favors they were supposed to get. But the country has gotten worse after the removal of Bashir than under Bashir, and it was pretty bad under Bashir. I was there. So there's nobody in the democratic, quote, reform movement or in the military that actually has an idea of what to do for the future of Sudan. And therefore, like my colleague on the other end of this conversation, I am too, do not see any grounds for improvement over the weeks and months ahead.
Mubarak Hania, let's go back to an issue that you just mentioned earlier about the likes of the U.S. and the EU remaining idle if they advocate a democracy worldwide, as they claim. Why aren't they doing more in support of the protesters? Is it because Sudan has signed a pact with the U.S. on normalizing ties with Israel? Is that why Washington is most likely treading lightly here?
Yeah, exactly. Because you see, when we have a civilian government coming in power, this whole process of normalization in the Israeli regime ideally should be taken to parliament, and the parliament should approve. And the Sudanese people, as we know, over the years, they have been supporting the liberation of Palestine. Hamas had an office in Khartoum, and they have been supporting Palestine. So if we are to have a truly democratic government in Sudan, devoid of external interference, this normalization deal, will be in tatters. And I think so. That's why the U.S. is supporting this military government. And the other issue we have to mention here is that the current military rulers in Sudan, Al-Burhan and his deputy, they have been working, they have been part of the Saudi-led coalition, which is at war with Yemen, which invaded Yemen. And Sudan is a major contributor of ground forces, foot soldiers, actually, which we can say, who are in the front line in Yemen, fighting the Yemeni people. So the UAE and Saudi Arabia, their interest is in seeing that the current military regime or dispensation remains in power, because they are part of that situation in Yemen. And as we know, the Saudi war on Yemen is backed by the United States, backed by the Israeli regime. So all these factors will automatically lead to the Western countries supporting this regime in Sudan, and they will not speak out against the killing of protesters because they are supporting, they are backing, basically backing. They might speak, they might issue some resolutions for the media, but we know behind the scenes that they are backing this regime in Khartoum, and they are backing the killing of civilians. So the people of Sudan, I think they are very resilient people, and they will continue protesting until the government, the military regime, listens to their demands. And there is also, a danger of another coup within a coup actually in Sudan right now. I mean, there is talk that some junior officers, progressive junior officers in the military, might decide now. It's time to now replace the old guard who are working with the Western countries, with the Israeli right. regime, against the popular demand of the people.
Lawrence Freeman, who benefits from this disarray in Sudan? There have been allegations of foreign hands, as you also mentioned earlier, namely some Persian Gulf states and also Egypt, of going to extremes to support the junta in Sudan. Why is that?
Well, first of all, when Bashir was overthrown and the West immediately came in and said, if you go with us on our Israeli policy, we'll make some changes in the size of your debt. Basically, Sudan has become, over the last 2 years, has lost its sovereignty. There is actually no longer an independent sovereign Sudan. And you have various forces in the world. You have geopolitical forces in the world who are using Sudan. Some are using Sudan to carry out their maneuvers with agreements with Israel and alliances with Israel. Some are using Sudan to join with Egypt to go after the Ethiopians on the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, which is unfair. And you have geopolitical forces of financial political elites that would rather see disruption, war, and destabilization than actually stable governments. And this crowd that calls for democracy, I think we have to look at them very carefully in the Biden administration. We saw in the Obama administration, you mentioned Libya earlier, the overthrow of Gaddafi, which was unwarranted, led to the destruction of the Sahel, which we are paying for now 10 years later. And therefore, this was not a productive move. What we need in the West, in my country, particularly the United States, is we need to have a new vision for Africa. We never really helped Sudan previously, and we're not helping Sudan now. Unless we have a vision that incorporates massive economic development and infrastructure, we're not really helping the people of Sudan. And in the democracy movement and the demonstrators, it's good to demonstrate. I demonstrated quite a bit in my life. But what is your policy? Who is putting forth a policy for the future of a stable, economic, prosperous Sudan? No one is at this point. And until that occurs, we have a major problem, and I don't think the demonstrations are going to stop. And I'm looking for some leadership to emerge that actually has a vision for Sudan for the future.
Mubarak Kenya, we're talking about foreign hands at play in Sudan. The Saudis come up there, the Emiratis, and also Egypt. What do each have to gain here, and why would they have any say in what's happening in Sudan?
Well, Egypt is, as we know, is a neighboring country of Sudan, same with Saudi Arabia across the Red Sea. But they are not acting as good neighbors because, as you know, as I said earlier, the Saudis have used the Sudanese army to invade neighboring Yemen. And as Mr. Freeman mentioned also, that as far as the Renaissance Dam is concerning Sudan, the Egyptians are also using Sudan to check on Ethiopia, and they are part of that escalation happening in Ethiopia. So, and the Emiratis also, as we know, they are also involved in Yemen. So all these regional powers, they are not acting in the interests of the Sudanese people, but they are using Sudan as a tool to achieve their geopolitical objectives across the region, and not in the interests of the Sudanese people, because Sudan is a country with great potential, great agricultural potential, which can feed Africa. Sudan is also a country with great intellectual potential, But all these potentials have been undermined over the years, and now it's a country moving towards the status of a failed state, which is very unfortunate. I think that's why the people of Sudan have to, you know, sustain their protests. They have to demand that a civilian government comes in power, which is, you know, elected by the people. And unless this happens, we are going to see the military selling out the country, because as we also know that the Sudanese military controls the economy of Sudan, fully controls the economy of Sudan. Almost all these sectors are controlled, negatively controlled, actually, by the military. So the military has an appetite of staying in power and exercising control, because it's in the interest of the generals to stay in power, because they are personally benefiting from being in power. But the lower ranks in the military, they do not see any interest in them, for example, going to fight in Yemen, because young people are dying, young Sudanese are dying for a war that is not theirs. They have no interest. They're going to kill, they are killing their brothers in Yemen. So there is also discontent within the lower ranks of the military in Sudan. So as long as these foreign powers are not acting in the interest of the Sudanese people, and they will not for now act in the interest of the Sudanese people, we are going to see any changes. And the other thing also we have to remember is that the reason why these Arab regimes like Egypt and the Saudi Arabia and the UAE do not want to see a civilian power in place in Sudan, because that will act as an inspiration to other countries. It will act as an inspiration even to Egypt, that the Egyptians will also rise up against the military rule in their country. They will rise up against undemocratic regimes in other parts of the Arab world. So they do not want to see Sudan setting an example or being a trendsetter for other Arab countries, and that's why they're really interested in suppressing the popular uprising of the Sudanese people.
Okay, one last question for Mr. Freeman. These democratic movements, historically speaking, do they have a chance at longevity in these African and Arab countries where a so-called president or a military strongman has held on to power for so long?
Well, I think they absolutely do. The problem is you can't look at this, the situation in Sudan, isolated from the whole situation in Africa. Africa is the only continent that went through 400 years of slavery, which was a mass deportation of people, went through 100 years of colonialism, went through another several decades of neocolonialism. So African countries have not been allowed to develop. Many of the leaders in the 60s who were visionaries were either eliminated or assassinated. Even the situation with Gaddafi, who is not a friend of mine, I was not a fan of his, but he had some very strong policies for development. All of these leaders in the history of Africa has not been conducive to developing stable leadership. And outside forces, like the political financial elites in Paris and London and Washington and New York City, they have made sure that there is not development in Africa. There is not the development of roads and infrastructure, such as the Chinese are doing now. So this problem of having stable governments has been a problem that's been also imposed on Africa. And I agree with my colleague. None of these outside forces have the interest of Sudanese at heart. And this is something I've been fighting for many years. Even the separation of South Sudan, the people behind that in the United States did not have the interest of Sudan at heart. If you care about the Sudanese people, then they need electricity. They need clean water. They need transportation. They need good hospitals and health care. And that policy has to come with a civilian government. It can't come after it. And we have to fight for those policies in Sudan today and for a representative government.
All right. Thanks a lot, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for tonight's show. African Affairs expert Lawrence Freeman joining us from Baltimore, and journalist and African Affairs expert Mubarak Kenya joining us from Tehran. Thank you for sharing your thoughts with us here on Spotlight. And also allow me to thank my guests for staying with us on edition of the show. It's good night for now.
bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The U.S. government is begging the British High Court to allow Julian Assange to be extradited to the United States. Doing so would be a human rights disaster, given that American prisons violate the most basic human rights of political prisoners like Assange. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Chip Gibbons, writer. This article is published under the heading, Julian Assange's extradition to the United States would result in serious human rights violations. Stay tuned for more. For 2 days, British prosecutors, acting on behalf of their U.S. counterparts, urged the U.K. High Court to overturn a judge's decision blocking Julian Assange's extradition to the United States. Although the United States indictment against Assange is a textbook example of a political offense, which are traditionally immune from extradition, the judge rejected Assange's press freedom claims. Instead, she found that given the conditions of U.S. prisons and Assange's mental state, his extradition would place the journalist at risk of suicide. In seeking to rebut this ruling, the U.S. and U.K. prosecutors' sadism was on full display. British prosecutors engaged in character assassination of an eminent psychiatrist who they themselves have used as an expert and implied Assange could not be suicidal or severely mentally ill as he regularly watched television in the afternoon. The proceedings also turned on the validity of U.S. assurances that Assange would receive humane treatment in U.S. prisons. Not only are these assurances filed with troubling holes, but even the highest standard of treatment, as outlined by the United States for Assange, would likely amount to torture. This is hardly surprising, given how the United States has treated whistleblowers and others accused of giving information to the media in prison. Given the United States' miserable track record in treating political prisoners like Assange, and prisoners more generally, it's clear that a successful extradition of Assange to the United States would result in grievous violations of human rights. Much of the United States assurances deal with the potential for Assange to be subject to special administrative measures, that is, SAMS, or be placed in the administrative maximum facility in Florence, Colorado, that is, ADX Florence, a supermax prison, two prospects that alarmed a UK district judge so much that she blocked extradition. The Center for Constitutional Rights has described SAMS as the darkest corner of the U.S. federal prison system, combining the brutality and isolation of maximum security units with additional restrictions that deny individuals almost any connection to the human world. SAMS include both physical and social isolation. Prisoners subjected to SAMS are already in solitary confinement.
Psalms forbid prisoners from communicating at all with other prisoners. Only approved family members and lawyers may speak to someone under a SAM, and these calls are monitored by the FBI. A successful extradition of Assange to the United States would result in grievous violations of the human rights. The SAMs apply not only to the prisoner, but impose gag orders on those that are approved to speak with them, including lawyers. Prisoners subject to SAMs are restricted in what information they can receive from the outside world, with prison officials being allowed to censor periodicals about current events. SAMs are reserved for national security and terrorism cases. Assange has stated he thinks he may be subject to them. Joshua Scott, the accused source for WikiLeaks' Vault 7 revelations, has been subject to SAMs since October 2018. Scott maintains he's not the Vault 7 source and told officials that whoever was should be executed. In March 2020, a jury failed to reach a verdict on the Espionage Act charges against him. The government is seeking to retry Scott, and he remains in jail, subject to SAMs, in solitary confinement, and not allowed to go outside after over 3 years. The United States has not guaranteed Assange will not be subject to SAMs. Instead, they have assured that Assange would only be subject to SAMs if, after he was extradited to the United States, he committed an action that warranted imposing them. This is hardly reassuring. The discretion to impose SAMs rests with the Attorney General, and the way Attorneys General have imposed SAMs is arbitrary, without any due process. SAMs cut off not only defendants but their attorneys from communicating with the media, a long-time goal of the United States and others when it comes to Assange. In blocking extradition, the district judge decided that if convicted, Assange would likely be sent to ADX Florence. In this prison, inmates are confined to their cells for 23 hours a day. In the 8-by-12-foot cells, everything, including the furniture, is made of concrete. Like with the SAMs, the United States has offered assurances about ADX Florence that are full of holes. The United States assures Assange would not be held there unless after entry of this assurance, Assange was to commit any future act that then meant he met the test for such designation. While the assurances are hardly reassuring, what is equally troubling is Assange's fate, even if the assurances are kept. In a declaration to British courts, Assistant U.S. Attorney Gordon Cromberg asserted that if Assange is brought to the United States and subjected to pretrial detention, he will most likely be held at the William G. Trousdale Alexandria Adult Detention Center in Alexandria, Virginia. Cromberg claimed there is no solitary confinement at the Alexandria Detention Center before he described in detail the jail's protective custody and administrative segregation housing units. Inmates in protective custody are not allowed to interact with other inmates. Inmates in administrative segregation, according to Cromberg declaration, are kept in their cells 22 hours a day. Bruce British prosecutors rejected the claims that holding a person by themselves in a cell for 22 hours a day constituted solitary confinement. To make this point, they drew on Cranberry's statements that inmates in administrative segregation are able to speak to one other through the doors and windows of their cells, and that inmates in administrative segregation can meet with lawyers. The United States claims, as parroted by British prosecutors, that Assange would not face solitary confinement are patently absurd. The United Nations Standard Minimum Rules for the Treatment of Prisoners define solitary confinement as 22 hours or more a day without meaningful human contact. Under the Mandela Rule, solitary confinement in excess of 15 consecutive days constitutes prolonged solitary confinement. Two successive UN special rapporteurs on torture have stressed that prolonged solitary confinement violates international human rights law and can very likely amount to torture. This is especially the case when inflicted on prisoners like Assange with pre-existing mental health problems. The United States' own description of administrative segregation offered to the UK government meets the standard for solitary confinement under international law, given that Assange is almost certainly likely to spend more than 15 days in jail awaiting trial. Assange's treatment under the United States' own assurances would constitute torture under international law. And Assange would not be the first person charged under the Espionage Act to be held in Alexandria Detention Center, meaning we already have a glimpse at the cruelties that await him. At least three whistleblowers have been held at Alexandria Detention Center. It is where Chelsea Manning was held when she refused to testify before the WikiLeaks grand jury. Similar to Cranberry's declaration, Manning's jailers claim she was not in solitary confinement, which does exist at their facility, but administrative segregation. Manning was kept alone in her cell for over 22 hours a day and was only allowed to leave between the hours of 1 a.m. and 3 a.m. Although Manning was removed from solitary after public pressure, the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture still found the U.S. government had tortured her. This was the second time a UN Special Rapporteur on Torture had made such a finding. In 2012, when Chelsea Manning was court-martialed for giving WikiLeaks the documents at the heart of the Assange indictment, her pretrial detention in a military jail was found to be constituted cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment and torture. CIA whistleblower Jeffrey Sterling described his own time at the Alexandria Detention Center in harrowing detail. Sterling recalled being placed in a holding cell with numerous other detainees. "We were packed in like so much garbage, sleeping on the floor and having to use an open toilet before being moved to a special cell block that also housed Zacharias Mosini, convicted of involvement in 9/11 attacks." According to Sterling, his time in this unit was in solitary confinement and he would spend days on end without being let out of cell. Drone whistleblower Daniel Hale was also recently imprisoned at the Alexandria Detention Center. After pleading guilty to one account of violating the Espionage Act, Hale was initially released on his own recognizance. But after a therapist reported Hale as suicidal, Hale was ordered taken into custody, allegedly for his own mental health. Such a move is perverse on numerous levels. As Hale's attorney Jesslyn Raddock told Jacobin, Daniel's initial time at the Alexandria Detention Center was tantamount to torture. After being sentenced, a judge recommended Hale be sent to a federal medical facility. First, Hale was transferred to Northern Neck Regional Jail, where he was housed in a room with 100 other inmates. When he was placed in federal custody, Hale was sent to the United States Penitentiary, Marion, in a communications management unit, that is CMU.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.